It's the 15th of February 2013, and you're listening to The Pod Delusion, a podcast about interesting things. I'm James O'Malley. Coming up this week, we answer the questions. Is the Pope resigning the end of the world? What do you get a PR company for Valentine's Day other than a punch in the mouth? Why on earth are teenagers now apparently conscientious and concerned about their fellow human beings? When debating whether science should use the art of persuasion, are you allowed to make a persuasive argument? And who was there to stand up for Darwin? But first, of course, the begging slot. If you enjoy the Pod Delusion and would like to support what we do, then please do subscribe and donate £5 or £10 a month. All donations are hugely appreciated and help us keep making the show week in, week out. You can also make a one-off donation. I suggest £28. That's the same as a membership to the Royal Institution for a year. So why not head over to our website and donate at poddelusion.co.uk. But now let's get on with the show. The big news this week was, of course, the Pope's resignation. It seems that God picked a dud last time round, as Benedict isn't quite so committed to being wheeled around whilst half-dead, being forced to mumble things in Latin. Still, I'll be glad to see the back of this Pope, not just because of the allegations linking him to child abuse cover-ups and his promotion of doctrines that run counter to modern progressive society, but because he's always pontificating about something like he's all high and mighty, acting like he's holier than thou. Oh, it's just arrogant. Anyway, first up we've got Chris Chapman, who brings us the news that the Pope's resignation could be more significant than we think, if an ancient prophecy is anything to go by.
The end is nigh. Hours after the Pope announced he intended to resign, the Vatican was struck by lightning. A sign from God, some were saying. What could be clearer? Well, if that was you, you can relax. Lightning strikes all the time, and this was hardly a bolt from the blue. Rome had 3 hours of lightning storms that day. St. Peter's Basilica, the Vatican building in question, happens to be 137 metres tall, and as everyone knows, lightning regularly strikes tall buildings. Take the Empire State Building, for example, in New York. It's struck more than 100 times each year. Nobody's asking if King Kong was the second coming. This is a classic example of correlation not equaling causation, and it's a common problem, assuming that two things happening must be related when they simply are not. But the more interesting things happen when you get a really emotive subject, and let's face it, the papacy is one. You get fascinating examples of people searching for answers in randomness. Perhaps the strangest example is when it comes to the prophecies of St. Malachy, the prophecy of the popes. Here's a short version of the story. St. Malachy was a 12th century Irish chap who had the gift of prophecy, even prophesying his own death, a bit like the Cyclops in Krull. On a trip to Rome, Malachy started having a fit, and spouted a stream of 112 cryptic phrases. These phrases were utterly ignored until 1595, when they miraculously were unearthed in the Vatican vaults. Each phrase is supposed to prophesize the coming of a different pope. Now, ignore the fact that the prophecies are widely believed to be a 16th century forgery and are dismissed by the Catholic Church, and they don't match up entirely with history. Let's just go with the supposed idea. Pope Benedict, or Glory of the Olive, as he's described in the prophecy, is the second to last pope. The next old boy to sit on the papal throne is described thus. In the extreme persecution of the Holy Roman Church, there will sit Peter the Roman, who will nourish the sheep in many tribulations. When they are finished, the city of Seven Hills will be destroyed, and the dreadful judge will judge his people. The end. That's right, we're at the end times again. This is another doomsday prophecy. Each of the phrases, like the prophecies in general, are so vague you can grasp at anything if you believe. It's open to confirmation bias, favouring evidence that agrees with your preconceptions and ignoring what doesn't. Here are some justifications of how the popes fulfilled the prophecy. Benedict XVI, Glory of the Olive. The name Benedict is linked to the Benedictines, whose crest contains an olive branch. His predecessor was John Paul II, who is described as from the glory of the sun. Supposedly this is fulfilled because on the day he was born, there was a solar eclipse. Before that came from the midst of the moon, but there are even more vague ones such as intrepid faith or burning fire or shepherd and sailor. Each phrase can be roughly shoehorned to fit a particular individual pope. This is the Texas sharpshooter fallacy, finding a pattern in randomness. It's named after a little joke. A Texan grabs a gun and blasts at random into a barn. He then walks up to the barn, paints a bullseye around the biggest cluster of bullet holes, and declares that he is a grade A marksman. Picking prophetic phrases and assigning them to individuals is just the same. You want to believe. and so you dismiss the vagueness and inaccuracies to suit your worldview. A great illustration of this is a joke paper in the 2008 British Medical Journal's Christmas edition. It was a study to explore the perceived wisdom that papal mortality is related to the success of the Welsh rugby union team. The idea being that if the Welsh win a Grand Slam in the Six Nations, a pope will die. In 1978, two popes died, and that's when Wales were really good. Of course, it's a joke study. Of course, papal death and Welsh rugby success isn't linked. The author's point was that you can tie almost anything together if you're willing to do it. I'll give it a try, in fact. Glory of the Olive. David Cameron's constituency of Witney has a pub called the Olive and Vine. From the glory of the sun. Well, Gordon Brown went to University of Edinburgh, and the series Low Winter Sun was filmed in Edinburgh. From the midst of the moon. Wait a minute. Tony Blair was played by Michael Sheen in The Queen, and he went on to star in Twilight New Moon. Clearly, Malachy was predicting British Prime Ministers. You get the idea. I've survived Y2K, Nostradamus, Harold Camping, Harold Camping's revised update, Harold Camping again, and the end of the Mayan calendar. I'm sure the world will survive another pope. This has been Chris Chapman, shooting wildly at a barn in Texas for the Pod Delusion.
Now, perhaps the other notable part of the Pope's tenure was that he was the first Pope to join Twitter. Sure, the other Popes may have started holy wars and crusades, but surely no one has wielded so much power to mobilise so many angry, angry people quite so quickly. Imagine if the Pope had retweeted Julie Burchill. So to take a look back at the Pontifex's vacuous postings on Twitter, or perhaps you could call it his papal bull, that's a history joke, here's Matt Greenfield.
Every town has an elderly eccentric that few people have met, but everyone seems to know. My hometown has a man who wears garish patterned trousers while cycling around on a bike covered in pinwheels, a bit like Noel Edmonds trying to recreate the ending of E.T. Whilst plenty of these amusing nutters will make bold assertions on behalf of the supposed creator of the universe, only one city has yet taken these geriatric ramblings so seriously as to put their author in charge. Pope Benedict XVI has been extolling wisdom, theology and questionable condom advice throughout his 7-year papacy. Only now he's joined Twitter, so we can shout into an entirely new and different abyss. Before his befrocked holiness had even said anything, his follower count burst past the 1 million mark. These presumably comprised a combination of devout followers and bemused heathens, primed in the off chance his senility wasn't being filtered through a dozen advisers, and he accidentally ended up tweeting that God's favourite creature was actually the Derelict Dunker.
I think it was Blessed Are the Cheesemakers.
What's so special about the cheesemakers?
Well, obviously it's not meant to be taken literally. It refers to any manufacturers of dairy products.
It's not even like his absurd follower count, online that is, not his absurd follower count in reality, was a case of follow-back guilt, since he'd only followed his own account in different languages. After the whole Tower of Babel thing, he really had no choice. In any case, a few days later he made his proper debut, in which he blessed everyone who'd shown up so far, which seems like an unwise strategy. I mean, what if there have been child molesters following him? Oh. Just like Gary Glitter, albeit whose Twitter account may turn out to be fake, the sudden appearance of someone directly involved in pedophilia on a public forum has invoked the wrath of keyboard vigilantes. Us pesky atheists, why can't we just shut up and let the Catholic Church systematically abuse children in peace? But, oddly, the subject of the pontiff shielding paedophiles and the clergy and silencing their victims from intimidation and guilt hasn't come up yet. All we've had so far is vacuous platitudes about faith straight from the cliché handbook, and what's more, they're obviously ghostwritten, presumably by the Holy Spirit. Judging by a video released by the Vatican of Benny supposedly sending his first tweet on an iPad. Ignoring the irony of a Catholic leader using an Apple product, what the video actually depicts is rather humanising. A deteriorating husk of a once malevolent and intimidating man, jabbing dazedly at a glowing rectangle at the command of surrounding sycophants. As an example, one of his more cheesy offerings was, "Everyone's life of faith has times of light, but also times of darkness. If you want to walk in the light, let the word of God be your guide." And the closest thing we've had to any political statement was, "I join all those marching for life from afar, and pray that political leaders will protect the unborn and promote a culture of life." Yeah, the Pope isn't like abortions, big shock. However, from the response he's had, you'd think he'd been claiming that condoms increase risk of STIs. Again. Let's face it, history doesn't favour some heartfelt disavowal of paedophilic priests to come anytime soon. The Catholic Church neglected to acknowledge that Galileo's heretical claim that the Earth orbited the Sun was in fact correct until 1992. Back in 2000, the incumbent Pope issued a nondescript blanket apology for all the mistakes the Church had made. That's a hell of a long wait just to see the horrific crimes be hand-waved off with all the sincerity of a sneering lord throwing a penny at the foot of a beggar. Ultimately, the Pope has joined Twitter so that he can quite literally preach to the choir. The ones writing the tweets are clearly not interested in theological debate or addressing the many controversies that surround the Church, especially since, as far as the Church is concerned, the abuse scandal is effectively blown over. Nothing will be tweeted that has been utterly exorcised of anything that may give cause for criticism. Those who lambast the puppet account of a feeble old man spouting myopic philosophies are frankly wasting their time, but may be better spent defending children from the monsters that he shields. With the announcement of his retirement, it'll be interesting to see if Ratzinger continues to tweet even after he ceases to be infallible. I mean, once you've been one notch down from God, it's hard to see how your career trajectory can be anything but downward. Assuming he's not about to pop his papal clogs, for which the only tragedy will be there is no hell for him to go to, maybe he'll try and make it as an internet celebrity. I mean, I for one would love to see him do a Gangnam Style parody, or hell, a Harlem Shake, or an episode of Kids React. Actually, not that last one. This is Matt Greenfield for The Pod Delusion.
Now, what's the difference between a suicide terrorist and a suicidal murderer? Mercifully, that isn't a setup line for a joke, but is the crux of our next segment, in which Salim Fadli has been wondering if there's any similarities between terrorists and the sorts of people who commit school shootings. Here's Sal with more.
Received wisdom states that suicide terrorists are rational political operatives, while suicidal rampage shooters in schools are merely mentally disturbed loners. But are these two categories of criminal really that different? Once again, I had an opportunity to speak with criminology professor Adam Lankford from the University of Alabama. He's been studying the relationships between depression and terrorism. I began by asking him to make a connection between what might initially appear to be two very differently motivated kinds of killer.
The thing that really stands out, the underlying connection, is that in most of these cases, they're motivated to carry out acts of murder or suicide. And what really stands out beyond that is that it's murder suicide against victims who are strangers. They're essentially innocent civilians. Even though these people often have specific anger against people they feel have done them wrong, they're lashing out against people who haven't done anything specifically against them. And they're doing it in a planned, premeditated way. They're claiming to be victims, claiming to have an ideology motivating them. Underneath it all, it's really murder, suicide, desire to kill, and be killed.
You describe these high school killers as non-ideological terrorists. Can you expand on that?
In a large sense, what they're doing is terrorizing the community just as much or more than some other things we consider terrorist attacks. But when I say non-ideological, the interesting thing is that my research suggests that suicide terrorists almost could be considered non-ideological in a sense as well. But the difference is that school shooters are less likely to claim to be motivated for a political cause or a religious cause than suicide terrorists. But underneath it all, really ideology takes a back seat in terms of these people's motives to personal problems and personal pain, which really is what differentiates them from other people who have similar ideologies but don't do such horrible things.
One obvious similarity is that killers of both kinds usually claim to be fighting for some kind of cause, such as fighting against the system, whatever that may be, which seems to be not that different to fighting against colonial imperialism. To what extent do these killers identify with causes?
Yeah, I would say not that much. For instance, in the case of school shooters and other rampage shooters, they have sometimes claimed to have a cause, like they're trying to spark anti-government revolution, or there was even an attacker who said he was trying to put down feminism, and other attackers, the Columbine killer, Eric Harris, he wore a shirt that said natural selection on it, which kind of has some ties to ideology related to eugenics and stuff like that. So, you know, again, the cause is not primarily what's leading them to do this. They kind of latch on to a cause because they want to seem more important and more connected than they really are, as if they're part of a broad movement. And sometimes in their suicide notes or martyrdom videos, you see that same kind of thing where they talk with the term we, referring to them and their fictitious or imaginary supporters.
It sort of reminds me of some of the excuses that killers often provide, such as Charles Manson's Helter Skelter, which, however hard you try to analyze it, ends up meaning absolutely nothing. It seems to be just an excuse to go and do what he wanted to do.
Sure. I think that's a good connection. But the odd thing is that in the case of Charles Manson or someone like that, we don't take what he says seriously in terms of his rhetoric. We assume that, well, that's just kind of the ravings of a guy who has much deeper problems. In the case of suicide terrorists, for 10, 20, 30 years, we've taken their rhetoric seriously because they're actually kind of spouting the same kind of stuff as a real organization. But in their cases, you know, really they're just kind of doing the same thing. They're trying to give a reason that makes them seem more credible than they are.
Given the relative ease with which firearms can be obtained in most of America, compared to the rest of the world anyway, it's hardly surprising that suicidal people find a use for these weapons. But usually these are used as weapons of suicide. What is it that turns a small minority of suicidal people into these rampage killers?
I think what really stands out is that there are all these causes that we know of suicide, depression, hopelessness, the inability to deal with a psychological crisis, failed coping mechanisms. But in the case of these rampage killers, they are not only hurting deeply inside, but they're blaming that pain on people who are outside. They're blaming their suffering on victimization and on others who they believe have been kind of bullying them, persecuting them, oppressing them. In the case of school shooters and rampage shooters, they're usually blaming it on, you know, other students or if they have a job, their boss at work, things like that, sometimes their parents. And in the case of suicide terrorists, they're normally blaming it on Western infidels or Zionists or the government or something like that. But in all of these cases, they're trying to lash back at people who essentially they're blaming for everything that's gone on wrong in their lives, even when it's not purely rational. So sometimes you'll have, for instance, female suicide terrorists who enter in a relationship with a man and they're not married and they get pregnant and it's a terrible sense of shame. And then you see them all of a sudden lashing out at the government. Well, obviously it's not the government that led to this kind of illicit affair and unwanted pregnancy, but they come to kind of have this distorted view where everything that's wrong is someone else's fault.
When the media talks about school killers, we tend to encounter either the lone outsider narrative or else these killers are described in almost inhuman terms, almost as if they are so evil they belong to some kind of predatory non-human species, when actually what we're dealing with here is somebody who may have been suffering a very extreme form of suicidal depression. What effect does this simplistic media narrative have on potential killers?
Well, what I would emphasize is the effect that it has on kind of all of us, you know, us walking around and thinking that we can identify these attackers because of these kind of outrageous overgeneralizations and oversimplifications. So there's a lot of people out there who assume that, well, if I see this guy and he's not, you know, walking around with cross-eyed and he's not looking crazy and he's not drooling, that means he must be okay, that he's not a real threat. What that leads to is them to miss critical warning signs or to ignore threats that people who seem normal or relatively normal make. So there are a lot of cases, the Virginia Tech shooter, the Columbine shooters, they submitted creative writing assignments to their teachers where they talked about carrying out murder-suicide attacks. And their teachers basically said, that's just a hypothetical, that's just being them creative, because they weren't acting like aliens, essentially. And there's a U.S. Secret Service study which shows that in actually 81% of school shooting attacks, the attacker told someone what he or she intended to do. So when we dismiss them as too crazy or too alien to what we're used to or accustomed to, that can lead us to miss the warning signs and not take it seriously. We really should be able to know, kind of in terms of suicidal people and people who are suffering, that sometimes the problems are subtle, and if we are aware of subtle things around us, we should be able to report them and get these people help.
Adam's new book, The Myth of Martyrdom, was released last month. You can find links to the book and Adam Lankford's research via our show notes on poddelusion.co.uk. This is Salim Fadli for The Pod Delusion.
Now, regular listeners will know that we occasionally have contributions from Michael Marshall, in which he pulls apart some of the terrible uses of PR in journalism. Yesterday was Valentine's Day, which has become something of a huge event for PR agencies. I don't know, I just think that Valentine's Day PR is getting too commercial these days. I preferred it back in the old days, when agencies would just put together a small campaign with a low CPT aimed at B2B audiences. It wasn't all about the ROI, it was PR for the love of PR. These days it's just all marketing. I guess it's just a different world now. With more, here's Marsh.
It's February 14th once again, and in accordance with a long-established tradition, the nation will be heaving with the sounds of relationships the country over being consummated. Specifically, the relationships between PR agencies and their satisfied clients, as retailers and businesses clamour to cash in on the Valentine's Day media free-for-all. If the exploitation of the most unarguably commercial of the Hallmark holidays is nothing new, 2013 certainly hasn't let the side down. The first rains of the Valentine's PR monsoon falling as early as January, as pioneering research into the evolution of the pet name was published in the Daily Mail Online. Move over, darling. Old-fashioned favourite beaten into third place as babe and baby become Britain's top terms of endearment. The research found that over the last 25 years, terms of affection such as darling and sweetheart have been superseded by newer, more modern and streamlined pet names like baby and love, both of which were actually only invented in the year 2000 as part of Britain's preparation for the Millennium Bug. These findings have far-reaching implications, according to researchers, who purely by chance are a sex toy retailer named after two common pet names. Love Honey co-founder Neil Slateford said, "The ways pet names have changed over the years show we are getting even more affectionate towards each other and a little less formal. As a nation, we're learning to lighten up when it comes to love and sex. That has to be a good thing. If I were an online sex toy retailer, I'm sure I'd agree that a nation of people lightening up about sex would be approximately a best-case scenario for me, financially speaking." Still, that the survey produced media-friendly results of potential benefit to the company carrying out the research should in no way undermine the credibility of this online, self-reported and entirely subjective poll, even as further findings from this PR exercise are explained. Quote, "And while the British might have a reputation for being unromantic, the poll found that the opposite is true, with 72% saying that Valentine's Day is a great excuse to show a partner how much they appreciate them." Unquote. If anybody is still unsure of exactly how to show a partner how much they're appreciated, there's a certain Mr. Slateford at lovehoney.co.uk with a number of expensive ideas for you. And if Love Honey doesn't quite do what you're after, you can always turn to an alternate vendor, such as Desire and Pleasure, whose own online self-promotional pseudo-research was featured in The Sun. "Cash-strapped Brits are shunning expensive romantic nights out this Valentine's Day and stocking up on sex toys instead," a survey claims. The lack of romance typically attributed to Britons is something which hasn't gone unnoticed, with British tourist board Visit Britain pointing out, "Britain too stuffy to host romantic visit, as Italy and France are preferred by tourists." While we Brits may be too stuffy to be romantic, we're not too stupid to recognise reverse psychology. What's more, the lack of romance in modern-day Britain is clearly an area of academic research fraught with controversy, as a study published in the same publication saw Interflora insist that Britons are actually a nation of romantics who constantly fall in love at first sight, with one in five Brits positive there's no better way to declare said newfound love than by sending a nice bunch of flowers. If only they could find a suitable florist, of course. While there's clearly some rigorous academic dispute over the romance levels of the average Brit, at least one thing is certain. Somewhere in Britain can arbitrarily be declared as being more romantic than everywhere else in Britain. After all, in any closed set with random variance, there has to be an upper and lower limit. And what better way to identify normal statistical distribution than to use it to let people you know sell perfume? When it comes to Valentine's gifts, we're actually blessed with a wealth of research, each piece diligently compiled by online survey companies, using questions written very carefully and very specifically by PR companies on behalf of businesses aiming to use Valentine's Day to secure column inches. For example, voucher website Groupon explains how flowers and chocolates just don't cut it anymore, and instead a gift needs to be something memorable, rather like one of the experiences you can buy quite cheaply on a voucher website like Groupon. And heaven help you if you think of getting any last-minute flowers from a petrol station, because voucher website netvouchercodes.co.uk have research proving such idea is a total no-no. On the other hand, as retailer Debenhams helpfully researched, it'd be a good idea to buy the lady in your life some posh knickers. Or perhaps you should take part in the British Heart Foundation's charity initiative to write a love note to the one you love. After all, the BHF's own research proves women prefer a simple, thoughtful gesture to an expensive gift anyway. But if you can remember one thing, be sure to remember to buy your mistress something nice as well. An extramarital dating website has research which says this is probably a good idea. For those in a long-term relationship, Valentine's Day isn't necessarily all department store knickers and online vouchers. There are innumerable pitfalls into which the unsuspecting lover could fall. Fortunately, there's a whole wealth of PR-led research with commercially valuable conclusions to guide an impressionable couple, with advice from MSN to avoid the relationship-killing public display of affection, and data produced by internet security experts McAfee, which proves that not only are your exes probably cyber-stalking you, but that those explicit photos you have on your smartphone are vulnerable to being attacked and hacked unless you can find an expert willing to sell you internet security. Even married couples aren't safe from the relationship curse that is Valentine's Day, with recent research proving that excitement, romance, sex and affection are basically dead in the water after 3.5 years of marriage. That the data was gathered by Co-op Foods probably has nothing at all to do with their Valentine's meal deal and associated TV ad campaign. Of course, if all else failed you, you could take up the lawyer who's offering free Valentine's Day divorces. And after all, there's only 364 days left until Valentine's Day, and there's a hell of a lot of spurious, commercially driven and scientifically worthless online surveys to fill in before then. This has been Michael Marshall, wondering just how red those roses are for the Pod Delusion.
Now, if you were listening to last week's show, you'll remember that we spoke to Helen Sersky about an event at the Royal Institution she was hosting on science and the dark art of persuasion. So, last week was the debate, and if you go to the Pod Delusion website on Monday, you'll be able to listen to it in full. But to give you a bit of a taster, here's panellist Marcus Brigstock, who's previously been on our show, giving his take on the debate.
I've got mixed feelings about this. I have very, very, very little proper scientific knowledge. There's one particular thing I've involved myself with, which is climate change, which might be up the sharp end of what we're talking about because it's a thing that's debated very, very often. Now, in the dark arts of science and the dark arts of persuasion, we're here having a discussion. Who amongst you are scientists, by the way, just by show of hands? Okay, very good. So there's a fair few scientists amongst you. The people, if, for example, we talk about climate change, who would oppose the information that you present to them wouldn't do this. So you're already screwed. They wouldn't bother doing this because it doesn't matter to them where on the kitten versus Romney lie scale they sit. It's irrelevant to them. And so when you attempt to take those people on in the media, you're up against people for whom that scale means absolutely nothing whatsoever. It's irrelevant, and they wouldn't meet like this because there would be no point, because the ethics, as far as they're concerned, are neither here nor there. And in fact, I suspect if you talk to Mitt Romney, I wouldn't recommend it, But if you had to talk to Mitt Romney, I mean, it wouldn't even be over a cup of tea. He doesn't drink tea. I mean, for goodness sake. Mitt Romney could, I don't know, I have no idea, this is an idea, but I think Mitt Romney could feel fairly safe in telling you that the lie he told was worth it, in the same way that the kitten is worth it or the spoonful of sugar is worth it, because he was serving a greater good. And whilst what he said about Jeeps being made in China and not being made in China might not quite be perfectly true, the thrust of what he was saying was far more important. And that, I think, is what science comes up against. I went on two occasions to the Arctic with some climate scientists and a bunch of artists. And the idea was that we worked with the scientists and then took the information and presented it in such a way as to make it more appealing. The organisation's called Cape Farewell. They're a fantastic organisation who I like very much, and I think it's been almost wholly ineffective. I hope I'm not tooting my own horn here, but of all the artists that were there, probably had the best opportunity, because what I do is work with words and usually make people laugh, and when you laugh you feel warm and fuzzy and you're quite receptive to the message. I've made people laugh talking about climate change. I doubt I've persuaded anybody who didn't wish to be entirely persuaded already that the information that I gathered in the Arctic was of any use to them. You know, I sort of, the way I did it was by talking about a series of anecdotes that took place. Helen, you said when you were talking about this, about a minefield that science might be walking into, and you said we might make mistakes which we might later regret. That's exactly the difference between science and the media, of which I'm a part, so I'm not condemning them entirely. Just to demonstrate this point very quickly, just the scientists, would you raise your hands again, please? I'm looking for somebody who looks particularly smart. Spectacles, sir. You have glasses on. What's your name?
David.
And what stripe of scientist are you? You work in usability. Very good, okay. What does that mean? I mean, I know what it means, but for the people here, assuming some of them don't.
So I'm interested in making interfaces easy to use, easy to learn, hard to forget.
Right, okay. Software interfaces. Okay, this might be a difficult... I might have picked, because of your glasses, thank you very much... Someone, okay, David. Well, we can try this. Do you believe in man-made climate change? Do you believe the assertions put forward by the IPCC, broadly speaking?
At this time, yes. If you want a yes or no, yes.
I did want a yes or no, and you've given a yes. Okay, so you think that that climate change is happening, that it represents a threat. And that it is in some significant part man-made.
Yes.
Prove it. Prove it.
Take a long time.
Well, we haven't got a long time. Prove it now.
Okay. I've been absorbing an awful lot of information, and I guess I can't prove it.
Right. Sorry, David. What? What's your surname?
My surname.
Yeah. David what?
Bell.
David Bell. Okay, is that Dr. David Bell?
No.
Okay, all right. Scientist David Bell said at the Royal Institute that he could not prove that climate change that he'd previously claimed he believed in. He said at the Royal Institute today, can you write this down because I'm tweeting this. A scientist at the Royal Institute today said he cannot prove that climate change represents a real threat, having previously made the assertion. You idiot. I'm sorry to have picked on you. It's very unfair, but I hope it amply demonstrates the point that they don't care. They don't care. The facts are not important. The facts are not important. If you haven't already done it, look at the Daily Mail front pages on anything. If you do read the Mail, read it from Monday and stay with it till Friday. Okay, read it for the entire week, because the thing that will give you cancer on Monday will cure you by Friday. The people who get unhappy are the ones who just read it briefly. But that is, I think, what you're up against. I mean, Tom Utley, who's a Daily Mail columnist, I've probably gone way over, I'll be very quick, I promise. Tom Utley, who's a Daily Mail columnist, wrote a long time ago about climate change and about ice melting. And he said, I'm sitting at my writing desk with a glass of gin and tonic in front of me. It has ice cubes in it. And as they melt, they displace the same amount of water in their frozen state as they do in their liquid state. And therefore, in an entire page, I conclude that the melting ice caps represent no threat to us. And at the very bottom, he put, unless any of the ice that's currently on land melts, in which case we may have an issue. But I seriously doubt anyone had gone that far. Anyway, I'd never even got onto page two, but I hope I demonstrated some points.
Now, there's only two sorts of businesses where you know that once you've handed over your money, you're probably going to get screwed. Prostitution is one of them, but this week we want to talk about mobile phone companies. 2013 is officially the future, and hopefully part of this will be a fast and affordable 4G internet on phones. But what's it going to look like when it gets here, and how much is it actually going to cost? Sean Slater has been investigating.
I live in the country. This means I get barely acceptable broadband, no 3G signal on my phone, and to get a 2G signal I need to stand in the back garden whilst holding a long metal pole and standing on one leg. Watching Kevin Bacon banging on about superfast mobiles or Usain Bolt's promise of lightning broadband leaves me going, meh, I can't get either service. Given that my mobile technology is 12 years behind most people's, why should I care about the promise of superfast 4th generation mobile broadband? Well, it's because of one of the requirements built into the latest Spectrum auction taking place right now. As a condition of owning the most sought-after piece of the Spectrum, Ofcom requires the winning network to provide 4G to 98% of the UK population by the end of 2017. If, as expected, O2, Vodafone, Everything Everywhere and 3 all win licences, they will start rolling out 4G services this summer. Now, there are several blocks of 800 and 2600 MHz spectrum that are being bid on. Keep in mind those two numbers, they might be useful later. Now, the process is insanely complicated, but it is fully expected that the existing main networks will win some spectrum, and one or perhaps two newcomers will also win a slice or two for localised use. Now, Everything Everywhere, or EE as I'm going to call them from now on, currently are offering 4G services in 16 cities in the UK. But the reason they're able to do this before the auction is simply because they had spare spectrum. When T-Mobile and Orange merged to form EE, they had lots of spare 1800 MHz spectrum left over from 2G services that, as a single provider, they no longer had any use for. Ofcom allowed EE to use this to provide 4G services before the auction, but as part of this agreement, Ofcom told EE they had to sell some of this capacity to rival network 3 in an effort to even the playing field between the four networks. EE gained a huge network infrastructure when Orange and T-Mobile merged, which meant that Vodafone and O2 were left behind somewhat. EE could dismantle redundant masts and thus save on a big wedge of running costs. They've promised to update the remaining masts to 4G across the whole of the UK, as a quote. As national players, Vodafone and O2 have to compete, but the cost of upgrading 10,000 cell sites to 4G and then try and build more sites to cover those areas left behind to ensure the 98% licence stipulation would be crippling. To overcome this, O2 and Vodafone have agreed to share their network. This doesn't mean they're merging or anything like that. It simply means that the physical masts and the equipment on them will be owned by a joint company called CTI Limited. Both networks will operate as competitors, and both will use different frequencies. It just means that in future, coverage for both networks should be near identical. There's a large project currently underway to upgrade both networks' sites around the country to 4G by December 2015. Together, the networks will lose around 2,000 sites. However, each individual network will gain around 8,000 overall by using their competitors' sites. Both have promised full 4G services nationwide by the end of December 2017. Three are promising 80% coverage by the end of next year. So what is 4G and how fast is it? Well, data transfer, as most of you probably know, is measured in bits per second. 2 to 4 megabits per second is reasonable as slow broadband speed, and up to 100 megabits per second you could get if you had cable or fibre. 3G in the moment offers around 1 to 3 megabits per second, but 4G, which you may sometimes hear referred to as LTE, is actually around 25, and possibly much higher. Now, this of course depends on the coverage, the time of day, and how many users are all trying to watch iPlayer at the same time, but it gives you an idea of what to expect. Tests on EE's 4G network show typical speeds of around 15 to 25 megabits per second. Now, unfortunately, in order to use 4G services, you're going to need a 4G handset that can use the frequency reserved for these 4G services. In EE's case, this is currently their old 2G spectrum, remember at 1800 MHz, and in 3's case, it will be the same spectrum which was sold to them by EE. But O2 and Vodafone's case, it's going to be in the 800 or 2600 MHz ranges that they're currently purchasing under the auction. Unfortunately, existing 4G devices now being sold in the UK won't work with these 800 and 2600 ranges, so manufacturers are going to need to update their hardware. This means if you buy an advertised handset in the UK now, such as an iPhone 5 or a Samsung Galaxy S3, it will only ever work with EE or 3. There are a couple of exceptions, such as the new BlackBerry Z10 or the Nokia 920, but it's worth asking your mobile phone retailer, especially if buying a SIM-free handset, if an advertised 4G handset will work on LTE 800 or LTE 2600 and not just 1800. How much is this going to cost you in future is a pretty decent question, but one that's difficult to answer. EE charged a premium for their 4G services and capped the amount of data bundled with each tariff. This was good news for the other networks because it meant that if 4G took off on EE, then it showed that the public would be prepared to pay a premium. Unfortunately, 3 rocked the boat by stating they would not be charging any extra for their 4G services and it would remain uncapped. And I expect this pissed off the finance directors of all the other networks big time. They are currently transfixed by the fact that over the past several years, revenue per user keeps falling, while cost per user keep rising. Now, I'm not acting as an apologist for the mobile industry, which has been pretty profitable in the past, but if networks can't charge a premium for 4G, then overall charges for 2 and 3G will likely need to rise to pay for the infrastructure investments and the licences. Whatever happens, you're going to be paying more for your mobile services one way or another. So to recap, 4G is coming. It's fast, you'll likely need a new handset unless you're on EE, but the services of the major networks will cover the bulk of the country and be more than a match for most home broadband. It may soon actually be time to throw away your home connection, but only if its alternative is cheap enough, and that may be the barrier to overcome. I've been Sean Slater, reporting for the Pod Delusion.
Now, back when I was in school, things were simple. The sporty kids bullied the weaker kids. If you did anything slightly less than conventional, you were taunted by shouts of, "Gay!" And any kids who were suspected of being gay would have their names prefixed by "gay" for their entire life at the school. It was a simpler time, one where gay people could be persecuted and bullied simply for daring to exist. Times are changing though, and it seems the Hobbesian world of the playground is actually becoming an increasingly civilised place. And this week we hear from Adam Knowles, who's been speaking to another Adam, Adam Castle, who has set up the first high school LGBT alliance group in the country. This rather puts my school's achievements into perspective. The best thing my class could do was cause the French teacher to have a breakdown. Anyway, here's Adam with more.
I'm here at Ackland Burley High School, where one of the sixth form pupils, Adam Castle, has just chaired a debate on religious attitudes to LGBT rights, featuring myself and a panel representing a range of different perspectives. We had a Unitarian minister, and we had someone from the Jewish group there. So Adam joins me now. Hello, Adam.
Hi.
So you're part of, in fact, you founded and created an LGBTQ straight alliance here at the school. That's a fairly new idea. I've not heard of that before, apart from in the States, of course. And I wondered, what does that mean, and what is it that you do?
So a group of students, sixth formers, same age as me, we decided to set up the group because we felt that although the school had quite positive attitudes towards LGBTQ people, there wasn't enough education and awareness. And we've wanted our group to provide both a safe space for students in the school, as well as working to tackle homophobia and transphobia. One of the first things we decided was that it had to be student-led, because kids in the school need to see that it's not an alien idea that exists in the adult world, that actually people of all ages can be LGBTQ.
What have been some of the things that have surprised you about the group that have met?
When we created the group, the first thing that surprised me was people that actually turned up. On the first meeting, we actually had 50 people turning up, which was really great. But now we have around 30 people that attend regularly. And another thing that's quite surprising for me is that they're in year 7, year 8, so they're about 11 to 13, quite a lot of them. I know that when I was that age, I would not be comfortable to
Come to a meeting. LGBTQ, yeah. Straight alliance.
Definitely. Yeah. So that's really nice. But one of the things that we set out in our group is that we don't ask people what their gender identity is, and we don't ask them what their sexuality is. We're open to everybody in the school, and we're not interested in their own identity, just that they're interested in supporting our cause.
It's in the end about justice, it's about fairness, and that's something that anybody can be interested in. It's great that you're doing that from a specifically LGBTQ perspective. And is it mainly to raise awareness, or do you have campaigns in this group?
Well, we've done a number of things. For example, for our LGBT History Month, we've decorated the whole main entrance of the school with lots of rainbow flags, of course, and also, perhaps more interestingly, have quite a lot of displays about gender identity.
I saw those on the way in. So there's a board about non-binary gender.
Yeah, I don't know if you've seen the something called Gender Bread, which is produced by a website called It's Pronounced Metrosexual. It's a really good way of looking at gender, how it's on a sliding scale, and we've reproduced a massive version of that, which we create ourselves, along with display about what transphobia is, and another display that literally just shows lots of images of trans and genderqueer people being part of who they are, because we felt that gender identity and trans issues perhaps are the least talked about. So we're really trying to push that, especially this month. But we've also done assemblies, we've done this panel discussion we had earlier. We've got more assemblies coming up. We were giving out stickers in the foyer the other day.
Were they popular?
The floor got covered in stickers, and the walls covered in stickers all over the toilets. We got a little bit in trouble for that.
Stickers. Everybody wants a sticker.
What else? We've got an event coming up on the 27th, an evening event.
Okay.
We've got speakers coming in, book writers. We've had Owen Jones in. We've had Ian McKellen in. I mean, it's really exciting. We've got loads of stuff going on.
How was Sir Ian McKellen?
He was actually really good. We started off making sure that we asked Ian McKellen, who's coming in from Stonewall.
Yes, under their schools programme.
Yeah.
Yes.
We made a point to ask the guy from Stonewall, who was with Ian McKellen, and Ian McKellen, why Stonewall is LGB and not LGBT.
So
we had quite a good discussion about that, and actually what was quite positive was that both people from Stonewall were quite positive to at some point in the future work towards that.
If I understand it correctly, their position is that because that's on a gender basis, not a sexuality one, then they see it as a separate issue that needs its own organisation.
I see that argument. I'm on sort of either sides. I think that you can't just slap a T on the end and expect all trans people to be like, great, now you're working for us, because really that wouldn't work.
Yeah.
Sometimes it just seems a bit odd. For example, when they're, working for equal marriage, that doesn't just affect LGB people. Yeah. It affects people that transition. People at the moment can't transition while in the marriage or have to end their marriage. So their issues and their things that they're working for
They are tied together in certain ways.
We see, especially a lot of people in our group, we see gender and sexuality as something that mixes in together and is more of a fluid idea.
And I think solidarity.
It's definitely solidarity. And on another thing, for example, they work a lot with homophobic bullying. And homophobic bullying not only affects trans people, but also what about transphobic bullying?
Yeah.
So there's just things that we just made sure that our group was definitely focused on homophobia and transphobia.
Yeah.
And we still support all the work that Stonewall do. We wanted to find out what their motives were for doing that.
Now, Ackland Burley here in Tufnell Park is a group of four schools that share a sixth form, saying before. Are you aware of other groups? Have you heard of other LGBTQ straight alliances elsewhere in the country at all?
I have read an article in the newspaper about a gay straight alliance at some other school. I can't remember, but what was quite weird about that article, I remember, was they said that we'll work for LGBT equality, but we don't have any LGBT people in our group.
And then
we used to have, but they're not anymore. So that was slightly odd. I found that. I mean, we're proud to say that we do have LGBT people in our group. We're not going to
out those people. And you've had support from the teachers and the governors and...
Yeah, lots of support. But yes, in terms of other groups, no, I haven't really...
So you're a pioneer, really. You and Rebecca and I met this morning as well. You're pioneering a new idea and organisation.
But I mean, one of the four... So in the four schools that are connected to their sixth form, one of them is Santa Union, a Catholic school, and obviously that can be more difficult, and we're definitely...
Have you found it more difficult?
So far we've decided to launch our campaign in Ackland Burley, the school in at the moment, make that really big, and then try and spread. So our aim is to work with that.
It all seems a long way to me. I remember the days of Section 28, where it was literally illegal to promote homosexuality, to pretended family relationship. Is this something you've heard about, that you know about?
Yeah, it seems crazy actually that what we're doing now is that used to be against the law, like,
it
not
literally was.
Too long ago.
And teachers are so scared of talking about homosexuality in any way. I mean, we've had questions from the teachers and comments from the teachers this morning.
We have never encountered any problems from any teachers. They're all really supportive, and I think they're just, a lot of them are probably happy that there's someone helping them talk about the issues that they might not know so much about. But one thing that we definitely need to work on is we're trying to get in some training for teachers so they feel more comfortable. Because, of course, if teachers aren't comfortable or don't have the knowledge to talk about these issues, then kids are never going
to
feel comfortable.
It's a tricky subject. We have to be honest. You know, you have to be careful what you say about it. And, you know, you've got to make sure that it's obviously age appropriate and that you're not treading on anybody's sensitivities while still getting the information out there. I think one of the things that we try to do as Gala is just stick to the facts. Yeah. You know, just if you tell people facts, you can't go wrong.
Yeah, I mean, I gave an assembly along with three other students to the whole school last week. In 10 minutes, trying to explain gender identity, gender expression, biological sex, and sexuality. In 10 minutes, we gave quite a brief introduction to that. But, I mean, that was the gender stuff especially is new to the majority of people, including the teachers.
Yeah.
But a lot of people came up to me and
we did a good job.
Yeah, they said that they were really interested. And so hopefully just that starting point, mentioning those things, they'll go and learn out more.
Amazing. I mean, I'm aware you've got to get to your next class, so just hurry up. But I wondered if you, today's panel was on religion and LGBT rights. Yeah. Was there any particular points or specific things that you found interesting or you learned today?
I think what was most interesting was hearing the different perspectives, or that religion doesn't have to be against gay and trans people. And it was really nice to see people being open to new ideas, which, because I often think of religion as all being against me and I don't really want to have much to do with it, but actually this discussion made me think that actually it's just maybe perhaps more about community spirit and so on.
That there are roots through. We saw the Jewish lady and the Unitarian minister, who are both in the religion and yet are LGBT, kind of fighting from within that religion for change. Well, this classroom's about to be filled with students, apparently, so we'll wrap up there. I think it's really great what you're doing here, Adam, and your group, and Rebecca. So keep up the good work. I wish you well, and thank you for this interview.
Thanks for coming in for our discussion.
It's a pleasure.
Now, also this week, of course, was Darwin Day. And if you go to the Pod Delusion website, you can listen to last Tuesday's British Humanist Association Darwin Day lecture with Sir Tom Blundell, and which was chaired by Richard Dawkins. Also celebrating Darwin Day were the Central London Humanists, who recently hosted Stand Up for Darwin, a comedy night. We were there, and we got a chance to chat to some of the performers and some of the audience.
Right, what does Darwin mean to you?
A hero, very courageous, very clever, wonderful family man, husband, father. Love him. Love to celebrate him. Everything to do with him.
It's sort of the shortest refutation of religion that I know.
Hi, I'm Chella Quint, and what does Darwin mean to me? I want to say Darwin means never having to say you're sorry. But I don't know what that means, so you'd have to interpret that however you want. I'm really excited because my parents live in New Jersey. Which isn't exciting in and of itself, but their rep, which is like their MP, Rush Holt, has just introduced Darwin Day as a national holiday going through U.S. Congress. And I'm so excited because that process is going to be so entertaining. But this dude is really awesome. He's a physicist and a rep, and he's a really cool guy who votes really nicely on nice things that people should feel good about. And he tweets as well, so you should follow Rush Holt, a nice rep where my parents live in New Jersey, and say good work on Darwin Day.
Very cool. Thank you.
Thank you.
What Darwin means to me is, apart from being a bald guy in a big beard, which all Victorians seem to have been bald people in big beards anyway, apart from women, or maybe the women were as well. Anyway, yes, it was his... similarity to my own, or no, mine was similar to his. He was before me, in the way that he lost his faith and became effectively an atheist, although he sort of wouldn't have come out and said, oh, I'm an atheist, you know, because it wasn't done at the time. But yeah, it was sort of various things happened in his family that meant that and he observed things in the world like slavery and so on, that made him think, well, if there is a God, you know, it's a pretty poor God that allows these sort of things to happen. Yeah, so I have a great sympathy for him with losing his daughter. I didn't lose my daughter, but came very close at one point, and that was one of the things that was instrumental in changing my mind about religion.
Wow, Norman, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
What does Darwin mean to me?
Yeah,
I guess so. To be honest, I only associate Darwin with evolution. I know he wrote lots of books and whatever, but for me, it's just about evolution. Evolution is like one of the most amazing theories that anybody's, you know, it's just one of those world-changing moments where you go, hang on, well, I can see how this works. And actually, once you've got the idea, it's really obvious, isn't it? Then everywhere you look, evidence of evolution is just, it's on every street corner, it's everywhere you go. So it's an incredible theory, but it just takes that one brilliant mind to find it. And even though, interestingly enough, there were lots of other people in the past who sort of seemed to have almost had it, and then, you know, he comes along and bags all the glory. But then again, you know, like every insane cult, us atheists do need a figurehead as well. And if you've got one with a massive beard, that's a big advantage as far as I'm concerned. Yeah.
Perfect.
Thanks very much.
Thanks.
Darwin kind of gave me my favourite joke that I did tonight about evolutionary theory. So about the giant lesbians and tiny gay men. That's sort of, I was reading some of his stuff that started that kind of train of thought. So, so I got him to thank for sending my mind off in a weird way. But I think basically, yeah, anything that makes you think is always good, isn't it? So yeah.
Cool, brilliant. Thanks.
Well, he's the guy who invented evolution, so you know that's good, isn't it? I've not really thought about it in those terms, but I like him as a role model. I see him a lot on the money. That's always handy. But beyond that, I mean, I prefer to think of him as more like the principles he brought forth rather than him as a person. I don't like to idolise people. I mean, I'm sure he wouldn't have been a fan of that himself. I get that impression. But I really haven't read enough about this to really have a strong opinion. So there it is. That's what I think.
Beard and money.
Say again.
Beard and money.
Beard and money. Yes, that's the two creeds I live by.
So we're in the backstage at Conway Hall, and what does Darwin mean to you, Nick Doody?
Right, well, the word Darwin means to me the same as it means to everyone else. I've decided to go with this consensus idea of language. So I thought if I started using the word Darwin to mean something that it doesn't mean to anyone else, it would just be confusing and divisive. So I've gone with it's a name. It is a surname, usually, although I wouldn't be surprised if some people have it as a first name. You know who you are. And it is one of Darwin, the famous one. I mean, let's not forget all the unsung Darwins who, you know, Simon Darwin, who's the first person to put a rubber band on an up till then useless wooden tuning fork and invent the handheld catapult. Should I have prepared an answer? Darwin's theory of evolution is unbelievably important for understanding the way the world works, and still lots of people either don't believe it or don't believe it and don't really know what it is. A lot of people who reject it are rejecting something that has very little in common with the actual theory of evolution through natural selection. I know someone, he's a comedian, I won't tell you who it is because it's not fair, but he once said to an understanding of my acquaintance that when you're going out on the pool, you're more likely to go after a girl who has her arm in a sling because she's like the wounded one of the pack. And that goes back to when we were lions. To which, obviously, my friend goes, we were never lions. I go, no, we were lions. That's just a done impression of him. That's not fair. But this guy sort of believes that the animal kingdom is a hierarchy. First we were mice, then we were dogs, then we were lions, then obviously monkeys, then... And he's an adult alive in the 21st century in a first world country. So, yeah, it's the battle is not won.
Very true. Cool. And do you have a similar story? What does Darwin mean to you?
Probably what Darwin means to me. The thing that I love most about Darwin, and I'm not sure that someone hasn't mentioned this already tonight, is the fact he looks so strikingly similar to God, which confuses the fuck out of creationists. And I really think that we could go through a process of replacing all those pictures of God in Sunday school with pictures of Darwin, and people wouldn't notice.
That would be amazing.
That would be kind of cool, wouldn't it? Yeah. And eventually what you'll go, and you'll say that, yes, Darwin is up there, and then you'll talk about Darwinism, and say, but you have a picture of him up there. You have been worshipping him for all these years. And they go, ah, yes, we should read one of his books. And then they might actually read it and go, there's some cool ideas in there. And it'll be converted. So that's my insidious plan. It's not as long as protracted as it was, but it's still quite a good plan, I feel.
I think it's an excellent plan. Thank you very much.
And that's just about it for this week's show. Do check out our website at poddelusion.co.uk to listen to over 3 years of archives, as well as the full debates from the Persuasion Debate at the RI and the Darwin Day Lecture with Sir Tom Blundell. Also on our website, you can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter if you're into those sorts of things. And whilst you're there, please do subscribe and donate £5 or £10 a month, or make a one-off donation. All donations are hugely appreciated and help us keep making the show week in, week out. So we really do appreciate it when you donate. You can find links to donate at poddelusion.co.uk. The Pod Delusion this week was brought to you by Chris Chapman, Matt Greenfield, Salim Fadley, Michael Marshall, Sean Slater, Adam Knowles, Liz Luckendorf, and me, James O'Malley, with additional editing by Liz. The Sketch of the Moment is by David Lovesey and Brian Too. Pod Delusion is a partner of the British Humanist Association. Thanks for listening.
Are you going away then this year?
Oh, I am, as it happens, yeah. I'm taking the family to this new theme park's being built.
Well, your lot love all that Disney stuff, don't they?
They do, yeah, but this isn't Disney. It's a whole new concept.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. Destination Abbottabad, nestled in the Himalayan foothills, we are off to Bin Laden Land.
No!
Yeah, whole new theme park being built on the site of Bin Laden's last stand.
So there'll be rides in that, will there?
Oh, I should think so, yeah. There'll probably be a version of that Thunder Mountain, you know, the Bora Bora experience, where you sit in a cave and have the crap bombed out of you.
Scream if you want to get blasted.
Yes. And you'll be able to watch the seals.
Oh, I love them. Catching fish in there.
No, it's not real seals, Brian. It's a recreation of the Navy seals taking out, you know, America's Most Wanted.
Oh, well, I did wonder how they managed to abseil down the building, you know, blow the doors off Bin Laden's compound and shoot him. You can't get a flip around a trigger, can you? Yeah, I thought they were just, you know, really well trained, expecting lots of fish in return and that.
Well, I'm rather hoping they follow the theme so, you know, you can have special breakfast with other homicidally tyrannical characters, you know, Gaddafi Duck, Didi Amin and his Doddy Men.
It says here they've even got crazy Adolf Golf. I bet you spend most of your time trying to stay out the bunker.
Oh, do you know what? I cannot wait.
Do you think they'll have a theme song there?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And it'll be a song about why, you know, even if you're hiding out in the far-flung corners of the world, eventually you'll be found.
So what song's that then?
Well, what do you think? It's a small world after all.